Shrink Wrap Radio number 340, Brain Lateralization and Western Culture, with Dr. Ian McGilchrist.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Ian McGilchrist, and we'll be discussing his theory that left hemispheric dominance of the brain has led Western culture to the edge of the abyss. Ian McGilchrist, MD, is a former fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and former consultant psychiatrist and clinical director at the Bethlehem Royal and Maudsley Hospital in London. He was a research fellow in neuroimaging at Johns Hopkins Hospital, Baltimore. He has published original articles and research papers in a wide range of publications on topics in literature, medicine, and psychiatry. His latest book, published by Yale in November 2009, is The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ian McGilchrist, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show. I've been reading your book, The Master and His Emissary, and it is so deep and so wide that we can only hope to scratch the surface in the time that we have here. But let's go ahead and give it a shot if you're up for that.
Definitely.
Okay. Now, your book is about the hemispheric lateralization of functions in the brain, and lateralization in the brain has become almost a pop culture topic in recent years, and I gather that that phenomenon has led to some rather widespread misconceptions. So maybe we can start with you taking us through what some of those misconceptions are.
Right. Well, there are the misconceptions that are broadly spread amongst the population, and there are the misconceptions of neuroscientists themselves.
Really?
Let's start, shall we, with the broadly accepted ones. I mean, of course, there was a lot of hype in the 60s and 70s and on into the 80s a bit after the split brain operations that Sperry and Bogan initiated in California. And for the first time, we could interrogate one hemisphere on its own or observe it in functioning. And this led to a lot of interesting information, and on the back of that, some speculation. And generally, a picture grew up that the left hemisphere was reasonable and down to earth and had language and was intelligent and all the rest of it. And the right hemisphere was somehow, I don't know, unpredictable, pink and fluffy, imaginative and emotional, and given to painting pictures.
Uh-huh.
And this led to a general discrediting of the right hemisphere and a sort of overbelief in what the left hemisphere might offer. Now, in the years following that, in the last 20, 30 years in research, it's become manifestly obvious that all of this is wrong. And that both hemispheres are involved in emotion. Both are very emotional and capable of emotional reactions. Both are deeply involved in reason. Both contribute very much to intelligence. If possible, the right hemisphere is slightly more than the left hemisphere, but let's not get contentious.
It's become such a metaphor that has spread throughout the culture that it seems like any workshops I go to, people start making generalizations about the left and the right and each being very specialized. But in fact, you say there's great redundancy in the two sides of the brain.
Well, redundancy would be one way of looking at it. In other words, they are both involved in everything. But in another way, there isn't redundancy, because what they contribute to each area of our lives and each thing that we're capable of, each skill, each ability each aspect of our humanity, what they contribute is very different. So so it's not redundant in that sense. They've evolved for two completely different purposes. And this, of course, has been overlooked because exactly of what you're saying, that there's a lot of loose talk about everybody thinks they know what the left and right hemispheres are like. And my first job is to say, no, you don't. Most of that is nonsense. And I sometimes start a talk by putting up a thing I've got from the internet where the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, their qualities are listed, and heading it up right and wrong, because it is all basically, you know, so much, I don't know what we're allowed to say on the radio, but anyway, it's not useful. So, as a result, most serious neuroscientists wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. It became a toxic topic, a kind of pop psychology topic, and in order to remain serious, they haven't looked at it. But this also is a fundamental error.
Well, let me ask you, what got you interested in this topic in the first place?
Well, it was, I don't know, it was a number, as it probably always is in life, a number of things coming together. I suppose one was a background I have I went up to Oxford to study philosophy and theology, and then I actually ended up studying English literature, and then I got a fellowship which enabled me to do psychology and philosophy, and then I read medicine and ended up where I am as a psychiatrist.
What a journey.
Well, it was a bit of a journey, but when I was doing the English thing, something very important struck me, which was that the whole process of academic discourse about literature seems to work in exactly the opposite direction to everything the work of literature itself is trying to achieve. So somebody went to great pains to create something that's absolutely unique, is embodied only in the words, or in the case of a piece of music, in the particular notes and in a painting and so on. You can see the analogies. It's concrete in those particular things. It's absolutely unique. And if it hadn't existed, nothing like it in the universe would be there. And the process of academic discourse was reducing it always to something abstract and general that you could have found almost anywhere. And then looking at it and going, well, search me why this stuff is so great, because I can't find any results in what I've got in front of me now. So the whole process of analysis worked in the opposite direction to what this thing was trying to achieve.
Well, hearing something about your varied background really helps me to understand the scope of your book, which is so wide-ranging. And I guess in some ways it's reflective of your wide-ranging academic path. Now, the main title of your book is The Master and His Emissary, which is sort of a guiding metaphor throughout the book. So tell us about that. Who is this master and who is this emissary?
Well, the story is something I took from a hint in Nietzsche, but it's essentially an old story. It's really the story of the sorcerer's apprentice, which most people know from a piece of music by Dukas, but it was in fact a poem of Goethe's and was a folk story before that. It's essentially about not knowing what it is you don't know. And the unknown unknowns, to quote a famous American politician. So these things are terribly, terribly important. Not knowing what it is that you don't know is your downfall. And in this story, the master is a wise spiritual master who looks after a community so well that it grows. And he realizes after a while that he not only can't look after all its business, but what's more and more significant, he shouldn't get involved with certain aspects of its administration if he is going to be able to retain the insight and the oversight that is very important to him. So he appoints his brightest and best helper to go off and be his emissary on his behalf. And this guy, you know, is a bright guy, no doubt about that, and he does a very good job. And as he's going around the place, he's thinking, look, I'm the one that does all the work. What does that master know sitting on his backside back home smiling seraphically? That's really not going to help me. And I'm really the one that does the heavy lifting. I'm the master. So he adopts the cloak of the master. The trouble is he doesn't know what it is he doesn't know, and as a result, the whole community falls into ruins, the master and the emissary with it. So that is a parable, really, about the relationship between as I came to see it after a journey that I can tell you about. But I mean, I came to see these two hemispheres of having a relationship in which one of them realizes it needs the other, but the other doesn't realize that it needs the one.
Uh-huh.
And the one that thinks it knows everything and doesn't realize the need for the other one is actually the one that sees less. It sees it very clearly, which makes it think it's very bright, but it sees things very clearly. But the price of its clarity of vision is that it leaves an awful lot out of the calculus.
Okay, and so I take it that the master is the right hemisphere and the emissary is the left.
Correct.
Okay. Now, prior to reading your book, I didn't realize that the two halves of the brain are physically asymmetrical. They're not identical. There's some asymmetry there. What can you tell us about this physical asymmetry?
Well, that was one of the first things that makes it entirely unscientific for anyone to say there is no difference. I mean, first of all, there's a whopping great divide at all, which is surprising in an organ whose entire purpose is to make connections. If its power exists in making connections, it's going to lose, apparently, an awful lot of power if it makes a whopping great divide down the middle. So that needs explaining. But even more so, these two sides are asymmetrical. So, for example, the left hemisphere is broader towards the back of the brain and the right broader towards the front of the brain than the opposite side. And then the right hemisphere is a different weight and size from the left hemisphere. In all social mammals, it's slightly bigger. They have different gyral conformations. That's to say, the surface markings are different. The cytoarchitecture, that's to say, the arrangement of the cells in areas in the two hemispheres are different. They have different gray matter to white matter ratios. They respond differently to neuroendocrine stimuli. They use different preponderances of neurotransmitters. So they're asymmetrical in every sense. And that's not surprising to a clinician, because a clinician knows that when you get a stroke or an injury or a tumor in one half of the brain, it's going to produce reliably a completely different picture from what it would produce in the other. So just saying there is no difference is a total non-starter.
Yes, wow. So you say that the information about the neuropsychological differences between the two hemispheres are not just curious facts, you know, about the physicality of the brain, but that the two hemispheres represent individually coherent but incompatible aspects of the world.
Exactly.
Individually coherent but incompatible. Them's fighting words. Tell us what you're getting at.
There's a conundrum. They're essentially and ultimately incompatible, but they have to be in some form combined all the time for us to be able to function. But they have completely different conceptions of the world. They bring about, if you like, two different takes or even two different versions of the world. So you're not aware of this. None of us is aware of this when we're just living headlong, because they're constantly being synthesized or very rapidly alternated, so that we're not aware of this. We're living inside a consciousness which is unified, but it's contributed to by these two completely different takes. And the reason for this is a very important and in some ways rather straightforward Darwinian problem. It's the problem of how do you survive eating? You might think, how do you survive not eating? But you have to eat to stay alive. But if you did only the things that you need to get that food, you focus down on that particle of grain, if you're a bird, on a background of pebbles, so you've got to be very, very carefully focused on it to pick it out with your beak. Or if you're locking onto your prey so that you must be absolutely aware of that prey and nothing else while you're doing that, or picking up a stick to build a shelter, you've got to go for it and be able to grab it precisely and use it. For all these things, you need a very precise, narrow beam attention, which is focused on one tiny part, about 3 degrees of the whole 360 degrees. Now, if that's the only kind of attention you're paying, you won't last very long. While you're getting your lunch, you'll become someone else's.
So right.
You have to look out at the same time with the precisely opposite kind of attention, in every respect different. The first attention is already committed to something that you know you're interested in. It's narrowly focused and it's precise. This other attention is uncommitted as to what it may find, because it's got to be on the lookout for anything and it doesn't know yet what it is going to find. And it's got to be the broadest, most sustained vigilance that you can imagine, instead of this very narrow, instantaneous and piecemeal attention. So these two kinds of attention are required by nature. And they're a very difficult thing to do with one neuronal mass at once. And my hypothesis is that the reason we have evolved these two hemispheres in this way is to enable us to do precisely that, to pay completely different kinds of attention to the world at once.
Well, that's a really, really great description. I mean, it's really easy to grasp in that way that you've put it. Now, you discuss language and the fact that language lives differently in the two hemispheres, right? Been told, yep. That language lives in the left and images live in the right. But fact, you say language lives in both.
Oh, definitely. And images, definitely. And that's totally uncontroversial. Everybody knows that. It's one of the reasons, in fact, why so many mainstream neurosciences gave up looking at what this difference could be, because they were asking the machine question, what does it do? And they got the answer, well, the right does language and the left does language. The right does picture, the left does picture. And so on and so on. In fact, the right does everything and the left does everything. But they weren't asking the human question, in what way, to what end, with what values. Because if you start asking that, and don't forget that the brain is as much a part of a person as it is a machine, you get a completely different take on things, which reveals, I think, some fascinating discriminations, differences between these two hemispheres. Because across a panoply of different activities, they line up coherently, the sort of world that you would get if you paid just narrowly committed attention to something you already know about, and another kind of world in which you're openly vigilant for whatever there might be. And you see, birds and animals have all this because they have the divided brains. That's where it comes from. It didn't start with us. So, of course, in languages, I just say that because you're now asking me about language. And don't forget that language, of course, is very highly evolved, whereas what I'm talking about is something so basic that it applies to the whole of our worlds as animals and as human beings.
Yeah, and in fact, you even discuss language or communication with birds and dogs and so on, and indicate that that our linguistic abilities somehow are foreshadowed in those so-called lower species.
Well, they are, and it's very interesting that, you see, one of the things that I was taught in medical school, which is clearly wrong, is that because language is this thing that so much distinguishes us from animals, which, you can argue, but I would say is pretty disputable, and because it's a very big thing, language, it needs a lot of computational power, then it settled in one part of the brain because it's more economical to keep it all together. It's more efficient to have it just in one hemisphere. Hence, this enlargement in the left hemisphere. Well, the first problem with that is that orangutans and gorillas and bonobos and chimpanzees, great apes, have this as well, that they can't speak. And we also know that from looking at the skeletal remains of pre-linguistic man, that he had this enlargement, even though he wasn't able to speak. So there's a problem there, and it turns out that it isn't actually to do with language, and it also turns out that language isn't necessarily what you think it is. In the book, I say, well, what do we have it for anyway? Do we have it for communication? Do we have it for thinking? Those are the two main reasons. I suppose most people would say we have language. And I demonstrate that, in fact, you don't need it for either of these things. You only, once you've got it, use it for those things.
Yeah, and in fact, you say that when you look at how the brain has mapped out various functions, that the hand is mapped out in the brain very close to where the I'm trying to remember this now. I think it was to the language center.
That's quite right, and this is widely known that language and the hand evolved probably together in a way, and certainly share the same part of the frontal lobe Broca's area, or very closely positioned together. And some neuroscientists have very reasonably postulated that, in fact, language develops from gesture, actually, not from vocalization. So the first language is embodied in a very obvious way. It's got so that we know it as very disembodied, but in fact, it's a very embodied thing, language.
Yes, and so you extend it to the idea that language is not so much about communication as it is about grasping, taking that sense of the hand, and grasping and manipulating our environment.
Well, that's right. I mean, in a way, one way you could think about the difference between the two hemispheres is that one has evolved in the service of manipulation. It's evolved to make us very good manipulators of the external environment. That's the left hemisphere. It's the one that not by accident controls the right hand. And it's also the one that controls the bits of language where we say, ah, I've grasped it. And that root grasp is there in almost every language when it starts talking about understanding. So So the left hemisphere is the manipulational one. I'm not using that in a pejorative sense. That's just a fact. The right hemisphere you could think of as the relational one. It's working out what these others in the world are doing, what the world at large is like. It's exploratory rather than grasping. So it explores territory. The left hemisphere focuses down on something that it wants and takes it. And so the right hemisphere is important in birds and animals for mating, for bonding, but also for observing prey and for generally understanding their way about the environment. So you've got one kind of part of your brain that's locked into grasping, taking, and getting. Very important thing, without which we wouldn't live and we wouldn't even have a civilization. But the other hemisphere is involved in a much more complex vision of the whole picture and what actually this means.
Wow. Now, you talk about a close connection between language and music and their evolutionary development, and that language likely evolved from music, from singing, a thought that had never occurred to me before. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I'm not an anthropologist. It's one of the leading opinions now espoused by anthropologists. Not everyone would agree with that. Some people think that language came first, and Steven Pinker says that music is a sort of useless acceptation, a bit like a taste for fatty food or pornography. But other people have thought that, no, there's more to music than that. And also, the evidence would seem to be, certainly according to some leading anthropologists such as Stephen Miven, he wrote a book called Singing Neanderthals, which is about communication using all the other aspects of language, actually, than the bit you'd get in written, the words you'd find on the written page. In other words, when we're actually communicating, we're communicating a lot of subtle meanings through inflection of the voice, through tone of voice, through posture and face, of course, through body language, and through pitch and rate, and through all sorts of other things, which is why actually it's quite difficult to communicate subtle things over the telephone, because it wipes a lot of that out, making telephone therapy harder than face-to-face therapy. And if you're a lover, that telephone call is nothing like a substitute for actually being there with somebody and talking.
Right.
So the kind of connectedness that, you know, where you're really actually communicating rather than setting some facts straight about a plan we have to achieve something with what's out there, you can manage without language. I say that the kind of denotative language we have comes along when we need the I-it relationship to the world, which the left hemisphere is good at developing. But that the I-thou relationship to the world is better served actually by the aspects of language which are in the right hemisphere, which is all the rest, all that implicit meaning, humor, irony, tone of voice, the way in which you say things, which is really so much the subtlety of great art, of social life, of just about everything that we do together as human beings.
You also suggest that poetry evolved before prose, and that seems like a similar theme.
Well, again, it's not my suggestion. It's just that it's interesting to note that, I mean, I was always brought up on this. I think it's a pretty old one, actually. It always puzzled me, you know, what, poetry before prose? But that's just because we got so used to communicating in prose. But the first writings, apart from number lists of accountants, are largely poetical in nature from every culture that we know. And in fact, when prose arose in ancient Greece, it was given a special name. Logos was the understanding of things in word that would be philosophy and poetry, but ordinary prose was pezos logos, pedestrian logos, the walking logos, as opposed to the logos that dances, which was the logos with which we communicated and understood everything else.
You know, I'm not a big fan of rap music, but it occurs to me just now that that might be tapping into something actually that's fairly profound in terms of our evolutionary history.
Well, I'd assumed you were a great aficionado of rap from your name, but I'm not.
Right. Uh-oh.
No, that's true. But, of course, there are other things about rap music. I mean, for example, it depends very much on rhythm as opposed to intonation. And a lot of the subtlety of communication is actually in other aspects of music than rhythm, i.e. in melody, if you like, and pitch. So, of course, these are involved in different aspects of all our communication. But the interesting thing is that the parts of the brain that are the same parts, if you like, the homologous parts in the opposite hemisphere from those that in the left hemisphere do language are the ones that are concerned largely with music.
You also discuss the idea of the relationship between language and the formation of concepts and suggest that we don't need language to have concepts, which flies in the face of my English composition teacher who insisted that if we couldn't write it, the thought did not exist.
And of course, there's a partial truth here, which is that you often think you understand something, and it's only when you've explained it to yourself and can explain it to someone else that you really do know what you're talking about. So I know why that was said, but it's strictly not true. The Sapir-Whorf idea, which was the theory that you're referring to, that if we don't have a concept for it, we can't have the idea. Some quite nice little tidbits of information. For example, there's a tribe in the Amazon called the Munduruku, and they have only words for 1, 2, and 3 as far as numbers are concerned. After that, it's many. But they can actually perform calculations as well as members of their tribe who have learnt Portuguese. And so, which of course has an infinite range of numbers as Western languages do. And for example, Quechua Indians have only 5 color words. So originally it was thought they can only see 5 colors. This is nonsense. They can discriminate colors every bit as well as you can. So we know that that's not true. But one story I particularly like is that of a French neurophysiologist in Montpellier in the 1830s, he'd made a special study of aphasic stroke, in other words, stroke that results in you not being able to speak. And then he had an aphasic stroke.
Oh, my goodness.
And afterwards he wrote, "I can no longer sustain the position that without words we do not have thoughts. All the time I couldn't find a single word. All the thoughts were there, ready to go. I just couldn't connect them to language." And we know that people who have semantic dementia, who, in other words, lose the capacity to identify anything with its naming word, can still do often quite complicated calculations. So they can think, they have the concepts. Chomsky used to say that without language you can't have the concept of recursive infinity. Recursive infinity means simply the idea, which we all do have actually from childhood, that if you add another one and another one and another one, you can keep going on this process forever. And we know that people who have no language in which to express this still have the idea. So we can put out of the window the idea that you need a word or you need words in order to think. You can think actually very sophisticatedly without it. And a lot of great mathematicians such as Einstein and Gödel and so on made discoveries, arrived at important, verifiable truths of a complex nature without using language. And it took them a very long time later to try and turn this into even mathematical language.
Yes, that intrigues me too. The whole process of scientific discovery, I think, often is not as it's portrayed, as a sort of a painstaking one foot in front of the next, as a flash of insight that somebody then spends a career verifying painstakingly, even going through lots of experiments that say, nope, this doesn't work. So they just find another way to do the experiment and another way to do it until finally they're able to verify it.
No, absolutely right. And that, of course, is interesting for another subtle point, but nonetheless a very central point, which is that a lot of people believe naively, and some scientists, not particularly philosophically minded, think it's fairly obvious that there just are facts out there that are certain, and you start with one certainty, then you add another certainty. And unless you're absolutely certain about it, you don't add it, and so on. So it's rather like building a wall. You've got a brick that's definitely a brick. You stick it on the wall, and the wall builds higher. But not only is the history of science not like this, it's largely extraordinary discoveries, which are then, as you say, later validated, and were not achieved by this sequential method. But it's also not the case that we are ever certain of facts in this way, or that we can, in fact, afford not to see things unless we've got 100% clarity, because we never do have 100% clarity. We kid ourselves that we do, but there's no such thing.
Now, you referred to the divide between the two hemispheres, and so that brings up the issue of the corpus callosum, the neural tissue that connects the two hemispheres. Tell us a bit about that and what the implications are.
It's an extraordinary fact that the brain has this great divide in it, because it could easily, over evolution, have done away with it if it had it in the first place. But it has chosen not to, in as much as that over the course of evolution, far from becoming more connected, hemispheres have become less so, in that the ratio of the volume of the cerebral hemispheres to the size of the corpus callosum has got bigger, not smaller, over evolution. So effectively, the corpus callosum has become smaller. And what's more, it only connects 2% of neurons in any one hemisphere with those in another. Of course, they then ramify into networks. And a lot of the effect of these neurons is actually to inhibit the action of the other hemisphere. So although a majority of the fibers actually crossing the corpus callosum themselves excitatory, they're glutamatergic, they abut on neurons which are inhibitory, GABAergic neurons, which actually ultimately are there to stop something happening, not to make it happen. And that is absolutely fascinating, because what it seems, and you can see this on imaging, is that when one hemisphere is processing on something, it needs actually to inhibit the opposite hemisphere from tackling this at the same time. At least that's what it seems like. So the traffic across the corpus callosum, minimal in relation to the size of the brain as it is largely there to say, whoa, stop, I'm dealing with this.
That's fascinating. So it's like one side is saying to the other, you shut up, I'm working here. Why, do you have any ideas about why that area of communication or inhibition would have gotten smaller over time?
Well, it seems that asymmetry pays. Asymmetry pays is, in fact, a maxim in the animal ethology studies of birds and animals. They've known about a lot of these things for a long time when human neuroscientists were busy going, no, can't be looking at that because it's Volvo ads and it's middle management seminars and we don't have any differences between our hemispheres. But the bird and animal people were doing what scientists should do, which is having a look at what was happening, and actually found that the facts were clearly are big differences. And asymmetry, animals that are properly lateralized, that do different things with their left and right hemisphere, have better survival rates, and they're smarter. And it's because they're not trying to do the same thing with both halves of their brain at the same time. And coming back to my point about attention, it may sound like a small thing, but actually it enables you to be taking two whole different sort of takes on the world at once, which is going to be far better than being stuck into one only. So over the course of time, we've become more lateralized, because this is actually more responsive to the environment. It's a better adaptation than being symmetrical. And one of the fascinating things is that quite a lot of neurodevelopmental disorders involve loss of the normal asymmetry of the brain. So, for example, in schizophrenia, it is often lost, occasionally reversed, actually, interestingly. But in any case, it is not the normal asymmetry that we find in the general population. And in other, this is true that there are abnormalities of asymmetry in the brains of people with schizotypy, with Asperger's, with autism, probably with dyslexia, and so forth. So although sometimes doing things in a very, very unusual way in the brain can produce a fantastic talent, it can also, and by the same token, make you less good at doing, carrying out certain tasks.
Yeah.
So there are gains and losses to this process.
What about gender differences and the fact, I assume it's fact, I've read it, that women have a larger corpus callosum interconnecting the two hemispheres, and it's been suggested that then they are more versatile in their thinking. Do you have any comments?
Well, I mean, I try to keep off this, actually, because there are very few very hard facts. Probably one of the only ones, as you rightly say, that most people would sign up to is the idea that, in fact, not throughout the corpus callosum, there are areas of the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum is divided into various areas, the splenium, the genu, and so on. And the female corpus callosum is broader in one of these parts, and the male corpus callosum is actually broader in the other. But overall, it seems that there is more overlap in what the hemispheres do. And that is fascinating because it means that females are a much more robust bet, if you like, by nature. And nature can take a bit of a chance on men, and it doesn't so much matter if some men are a success and some aren't, evolutionarily speaking. But women have got to be okay because they're actually going to bring up the next generation. They're the backbone of the race, of the civilization. And so it seems to me that a more dependable model is the one which it seems that nature has chosen for the female brain, which is there is more overlap. What this means is that female brains are much less susceptible to neurodevelopmental disorders of the kind I'm talking about. So, once again, they're commoner, about four times commoner in men than they are in women. And I think that's because there is less overlap. Now, you can argue either way about this. Is it better to have more overlap or less overlap? One way of looking at it is more overlap is more robust. The other way of looking at it is less overlap is actually the way that the brain is trying to go, because actually if it's a success, and it can be a failure, then it's, in other words, a more risky option. And it might explain why you get something called greater male variability, which is a fairly well-known phenomenon in the psychology circles, which is that, generally speaking, you tend to find men overrepresented both at the bottom and at the top of just about any distribution you care to name. It's probably because their slightly riskier brains, when they work well, are going to be very good, but when they don't work well, are going to be a mistake.
Okay. We've been talking about attention here, and I was really fascinated by your discussion of hypnosis at the end of chapter 6. I did my own doctoral dissertation on the role of attention in meditation and hypnosis, and that was long before the development of brain imaging. As you point out, most people would probably assume that the hypnotic state would be characterized by right brain dominance. However, you cite a number of research studies indicating just the opposite. You then go on to make a generalization about our left brain dominated Western culture and suggest that it is as if we were all in a somnambulistic state marching off the abyss. What is that abyss that we are blindly stumbling into?
Well, I hardly think I need to underline it, do I? I mean, look what we're doing to the planet. I know that it's possible to say, oh, we'll find a way out of this in the end. We're bright, we'll fix it. That sounds very much like the emissary speaking. You know, I'm a bright chap. The trouble is that you don't always, with this kind of take on it, you don't know what it is that you're messing with or what you're destroying and how difficult it will be ever to sort it out. I mean, course, I'm not here to say let's save the planet. The planet will save itself. Long after we've gone, the planet will have other plans. Yeah. And perhaps something better adapted will come along that's less damaging. But human beings are they're very wonderful. Very wonderful creation, of course, but they're also capable of enormous mass stupidity and greed. And it seems in the West that we're unhappier than we used to be. We're despoiling the world at a rate of knots. Our societies are not as cohesive as they used to be. And, you know, I'm well aware that other people with an optimistic bent of mind will point to all kinds of things. So that conversation goes nowhere in a short radio interview. But my feeling is that we are messing up because we are losing track of the sort of things that our right hemispheres would tell us about the nature of the world. Instead, we're seeing it as a heap of resource to be exploited, apparently in the pursuit of happiness. But actually, that's something we're definitely not doing very well. So, given that most mental illnesses appear to be on the rise, so there's a fundamental problem there. And really, what I point to in the book is evidence, which there's quite a lot, that the left hemisphere is the hemisphere of denial. It starts from quite simple things like when you have insight or don't have insight in a mental illness. It seems that the insight increases with right frontal activity returning. And the insight disappears when the right frontal activity is low. Then we know from lovely studies done with one half of the brain isolated at a time, some clever neuropsychologists gave personality inventories to these people to complete, one completed by the left hemisphere and the other when they had only the right hemisphere active. And they gave the same questionnaires to their friends and family. And lo and behold, it turns out that the left hemisphere has a rather, shall we say, polished view of itself and of its talents compared with what other people think. And the right hemisphere, if anything, more accurate, certainly, but slightly more on the tarnished side. And you get these extraordinary phenomena when people have damaged their right hemisphere, and so they're relying only on their left hemisphere, and they're unaware of their limitations. They can't be rehabilitated because they're just completely incapable of seeing how limited they've become, and therefore working on the limitations and overcoming them. And you get the most extreme example of this when people have a stroke. You know, this is something that you can see on any medical ward. This is not some rare syndrome I dug up, but you know, somebody might come in the night with a right hemisphere stroke. So the left side of their body may not be moving at all. You go and see them in the morning and say, how are you? And they say, fine. And you say, oh, that's good to hear. Any problems? They say, no, thanks. They say, well, any problems specifically with your left arm, for example? No. Can you move it okay? Yeah, sure. Well, move it then. So they go there and you don't see anything move, see? And they say, well, I didn't see anything move. And you bring it around right in front of them and say, there, now move that. And they go, oh, that's not my arm. That belongs to the bloke in the next bed.
Oh, my
now,
goodness.
These are not people who are psychotic. They're not in another sort of planet, if you see what I mean. They're people who simply can't accept that there's something wrong. They're not aware of it when they're working only on their left hemisphere. Now, if I'm right that we are a culture which is not that our brains have suddenly altered, and if you scan people's brains now, you'd see they're completely different from 500 years ago. But that if we're relying only on the take that the left hemisphere gives us increasingly and forgetting and ruling out the sort of stuff the right hemisphere would be telling us, then I wouldn't expect insight to be the keynote. I'd expect us to be, as I say in the book, somnambulistically heading towards the abyss while whistling a happy tune.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the book, like the brain, is divided into two parts. In the second part, you bravely take on how the brain has shaped our world, taking on the evolution of culture through the ancient world and you take us through the Renaissance and the Reformation and on into the Enlightenment, into Romanticism and the Industrial Revolution, ending in the modern and postmodern worlds. And I'm afraid we're not going to have time to go through all that here. So people will they'll just have to read the book.
They'll just have to read the book.
Yeah. Some years back, there was a fairly popular book written by Julian Jaynes titled The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. in which it,
that's right.
And if I recall correctly, he asserted that we were more prone to hear the gods in ancient times because our right hemisphere had more sway back then. Is what you're saying something like that? Were you influenced by Julian Jaynes at all?
I was very interested by Julian Jaynes, and I have respect for him. I mean, he was enormously wrote a fantastically interesting book. I mean, I happen to think he got things back to front, but that's not to say I don't respect him and haven't learned from him. I think that rather than modern consciousness resulting from the breakdown of the bicameral mind, in other words, the mind that used to be two chambers becoming one, in other words, the two hemispheres becoming more cohesive, I think it's exactly the opposite effect. They've become less cohesive. They've become more separate. And that, no doubt, as I say, has good evolutionary there are good evolutionary reasons for that happening. But it's not that the voices of the gods were suddenly made accessible because of the breakdown in the wall between the two hemispheres. It's that the voices of the gods, if they come from the right hemisphere, as James was suggesting, as I think that seems perfectly reasonable, have become alien-sounding, spooky, uncanny. In other words, divine sounding, no longer part of me, now that the right hemisphere has been hived apart from the left. So it's exactly the opposite, I'm saying, really, but close enough. But what I thought was most fascinating was some work by Louis Sass, S-A-S-S, Louis Sass, who's a professor, distinguished professor at Rutgers of psychology, but also very knowledgeable about the history of philosophy and literature. And he wrote a wonderful and subtle book, which has become a classic, called Madness and Modernism, in which he shows the parallels between the world inhabited by a schizophrenic subject and the world evoked by modernist art, modernist literature, modernist thought. And it's a fantastic book, so I recommend it to all your readers. They won't be disappointed. But this idea was to me absolutely intriguing, because if it's true that the world conjured up by the art and the life of the 20th century is like the world of a schizophrenic subject, fragmented, deracinated, alienated, decontextualized, bizarre, all these things, it's also true that if you wanted to create a mind that was like a schizophrenic mind from a normal one, you put lots and lots of holes in the right hemisphere of the brain. In other words, schizophrenia mimics a left hemisphere in a kind of crazy overdrive with a right hemisphere that is not working properly either. So the imbalance, though, is towards the vision of the left hemisphere. Now, there's an awful lot that I could say about that and would need to qualify about that and so forth. So if your readers are saying, well, but, you know, sorry, your listeners are saying that, then they need to get my book and have a look at what I actually say there.
Yeah, it feels like your countryman R.D. Lang would fit in somewhere here. Do you see any connection with his view of schizophrenia and what you're saying?
Not really, no. I have respect for some of what Lang did, but I also think that his fundamental idea that, you know, there were the schizophrenogenic mums has done incalculable harm. And he didn't know, I suppose, at the time that it was a very painful and heartless thing to be promulgating. But we don't know that that's nonsense now, which, of course, is a very good thing you can say to a parent. If they have a child that has schizophrenia, usually this becomes manifest only in the late teens and early 20s. And it's nothing that they've done.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'd forgotten that he was attached to that idea.
My point is simply that if it is true that the left hemisphere has a take which is rather like that of a schizophrenic, and if it's true that our world, as Louis Sass says, its art, its thinking, its processes, in fact, mimic this. And in the last part of the book, I show how very real that prospect might be. Then it seems to me to be a fair possibility that at different times in history, when we've seen things differently and been able to understand things that we seem to have lost sight of more recently in the last 150 years, we may have been using and drawing on aspects of our brain differently from the way we do now. That's really all I'm saying. I'm not saying that the brain physically has altered very much, but it does offer these two takes, which are not entirely compatible. So there's always a bit of a tension between them. And it's possible for the left hemisphere take, which is interested in consistency, to drive out the right. The right wouldn't really drive out the left, because if you remember, the master knows it needs the emissary. That's what it appointed the emissary for. It knows there's two kinds of thinking required. The left hemisphere thinks there's only one kind of thinking required, and that's the problem.
Yes. Now, you do paint a fairly bleak picture in the last chapter, The Master Betrayed, and where you picture a left hemisphere-dominated culture which is affecting art, spirituality, our bodies. No time to go into all that here, but let me ask you, what gives you cause for hope? Because you do end up on a hopeful note.
Well, I call myself a hopeful pessimist. And by that, I mean I always have hope, because human beings are extraordinarily resourceful and extraordinarily unpredictable. And it would be foolish for anyone to think that they could say now what was coming in 10, 15 years' time. One thing I know for sure from the response that I've had to my book, which has been by a factor of 10 or 100, far more than anything I anticipated would be possible. I mean, I get emails from people in all walks of life from all over the world every day.
Wow.
Saying how much my book has, in essence, articulated for them something that they knew already, if you like. Now, these people are tired of the take that they're being peddled all the time as the only reasonable take to have on the world. A very unsophisticated, very simple, reductionist, mechanistic model, which I am not saying doesn't work. It works fine for certain purposes, but which really doesn't help you understand the world and produces only a very impoverished version of life, if that's the one that you adhere to. That one has now driven out a more sophisticated understanding, such as people might have had in other ages, and such as people have, until very recently, been able to maintain, along with a very high degree of technological sophistication in the East. I'm slightly worried about the way that the Far East is now trying to out-Occidentalize the West, and we may be losing something we could learn from there. I point in my book to research in the last 20 years, which shows that Far Easterners are able to draw on strategies of left and right hemisphere equally in a way that we don't. We tend to be skewed very, very much to just one point of view, which we hammer away at. So we could learn from the East. That's one reason for hope. People's sheer sort of frustration with the world picture that they're being peddled as the only reasonable one now, I think, is going to make sure that people move to a more balanced and enlightened point of view before long. In the history of ideas, this has usually happened. We haven't got very long, though, if we poison the planet at the rate we're going. We've got to get on we've got to get going on this. And so, you know, there are signs, there are reasons for hope. People are more interested in things of a nature that would give one hope, like mindfulness and meditation, which are ways in which of actually clarifying one's mind and attending to the world rather than conceptualizing it automatically and thinking that one's understood it. All of these things are sort of small signs of things that are good, but there is reason also to be worried. I mean, I was just talking in Canada recently, and a woman came up to the microphone when I finished speaking and said, I teach 5 to 7 year olds, and my colleagues and I have realized in the last few years, but only in the last few years, that we actually have to teach children how to read the human face. Now, I don't know how that hits you, but that seems pretty much a terrible thing for humanity, if that's the case.
Yeah, yeah.
Until recently, only autistic children would have to be taught how to read face.
Wow.
And if you put that together with other things I've heard from many people, teachers saying, you know, in the last few years, people were not able to do things that until very recently all my class could do, often sustaining attention, and other evidence that children are less empathic nowadays. Now, if there are three things that the right hemisphere, compared with the left, is particularly good at, it's reading human faces, empathizing, and sustaining attention. So it looks like it's literally true, which is what I'm saying, that actually we're shifting away from understanding what our right hemisphere would tell us into a prism constructed by the way the left hemisphere looks at the world.
Wow. to kind of wrap things up, you're a psychiatrist. Are there implications in what we've been discussing here for the theory and practice of psychotherapy?
There are indeed. They cover things like the nature of the process that we're engaging with, which is essentially the right hemisphere of the therapist with the right hemisphere of the patient. But the sort of techniques that one would use, the sort of imagery and style, which is much less verbal perhaps than a lot of psychotherapy has been in the past. So yeah, there are links, and I'm in some exciting research with therapists who are carrying out research in their daily practice with patients, putting my ideas into practice and apparently having very good results. So this is interesting.
Oh, yes, that does sound very interesting. It makes me think of Milton Erickson getting back to hypnosis, and who used a lot of metaphor and stories and so on, and was reportedly very effective.
Whole body psychotherapy in the sense of involving movement and so forth in the therapy. So I think it's exciting. I mean, it's just at the stage of being experiment. So nothing hard going on there in terms of data.
Okay. Well, you've been very generous with your time, Dr. Ian McGilchrist. It's been great to speak with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much. I just wish we could have talked for much longer.
Me too. Okay. I must say that I'm blown away by the depth and breadth of Dr. McGilchrist's vision. He strikes me as something of a Renaissance man with his command of not only current neuroscience, but also many other areas of research, as well as evolutionary anthropology, philosophy, literature, and cultural history, among others. Oh, and I forgot to mention medicine in general and psychiatry in particular. I come away from this interview with the understanding that the two hemispheres of the brain represent two different ways of knowing. I love the example he gave of the bird pecking for seeds on the ground, with a highly focused attention on finding the seeds to peck at being the work of the left brain, and the broader view of the environment to keep from being eaten itself as more or less the work of the right brain. While he's quick to shy away from oversimplification, having observed that nearly every function is represented in one way or another on both sides of the brain, he does give us an understanding of the left hemisphere as having a primarily narrow focus, and the right hemisphere having a much broader view of the inner and outer environment. So it's not that one way of knowing is wrong and the other is right. Rather, there are two different narratives about what is real and true. Both narratives are accurate in their own way, and we need both. But if one becomes too dominant, it becomes perilous for our survival, both as individuals and, as he suggests, for our Western culture. It's interesting that folks who have been skeptical about our over-reliance on the scientific way of knowing, of an over-reliance on step-by-step logical deduction and exclusive dependence on the evidence of our senses, find support for alternative ways of knowing. And I was fascinated to discover that he sees such processes as meditation, and I suspect appreciation for literature, art, music, and poetry, as a necessary antidote to our cultural left brain dominance. Some would say that he has taken too far a leap from the neural scientific evidence. It certainly is a daring synthesis that he has advanced for our consideration. I'm not sure if it stands up to scientific scrutiny or not, but I must say it certainly strikes a resonant chord within me. How about you? Dr. McGilchrist's very informative and thought-provoking book is available on Amazon.com in both a hardback and Kindle format, and both are quite reasonably priced for a book that's around 600 pages in length. If you decide to order it, I hope you'll use our Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
Hi, I'm Heather. I'm a graduate student, and I was really excited to stumble upon Shrink Wrap Radio and an article with an author whose articles I've been reading recently. It was very cool to hear. I chose to send a contribution to Shrink Wrap Radio because I really want to support this kind of grassroots educational initiative that's being done. I made a small contribution, and I figure, you know, for every I gained something from it by listening to it, and I would like to support that being out there for other people to hear. And I just, it's a really cool thing that you guys are doing, and so thank you.
Thank you, Heather, for sharing your reasons for supporting Shrink Wrap Radio. The fact that you've chosen to do that, even on the limited income of a graduate student, will hopefully inspire others to click on that multicolored support button in our right-hand sidebar. Congratulations to longtime listener, supporter, and guest Peter B. Todd in Australia. You might recall that his book, The Individuation of God, which is advertised in the right-hand sidebar on our site, and has just been reviewed very positively by Leonard Cruz, MD, on the Asheville Jung Center site. So congratulations, Peter. I'm glad your book is gaining notice in the Jungian community. Now here's a February/March special from the Jung platform. I want to let you know about an offer from my Jung platform partner that I think will be sure to interest many of you. Are you a fan of Rumi, the Persian poet? I suspect many of you are. If so, you may also be familiar with the name Coleman Barks, who has been the principal translator and popularizer of Rumi's poems. I understand he's also a terrific storyteller and reader. I'd hoped to interview him, but his schedule is too crowded. However, my listeners will be able to get a 10% discount using my discount code of Dr. Dave on either live viewing or a subsequent viewing of a presentation he'll be giving in Salt Lake City on February 28 at 6 p.m. As I say, you can view it live or subsequently get the CD or stream it for $19.75 minus a 10% discount for using my code of Dr. Dave. That's D-R-D-A-V-E. I'll also put a link in red in the show notes for this episode. I'm pleased to announce a new transcript of episode number 337, Using Dreams in Healthcare with Dr. Christopher Soten. And that transcript is due to volunteer Gloria Ullman, who has done others for us as well. So thank you so much, Gloria. Also, don't forget you'll find my new 8 CE unit course on neuroscience and healing under the store tab on our site, along with lots of other continuing education credits through the Zur Institute. And remember, you can also make money on our site. You'll find a text link in the right-hand sidebar that says, click here to earn money taking online surveys. And that will take you to one of my marketing research partners who pay people to take surveys. So it's not quite free, but for a bit of your labor, you can make some moolah, and a little slice will go to help support this show.
Hi, this is Australian psychologist and author Dr. James Alexander, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. James Alexander, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. Actually, it looks like I have only one email to share today. Typically, when I'm going through my email, I put a color code on the ones that are from Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. I seem to recall that there might have been more, so it may be that some of the color codes got dropped. I'm not sure. But I'm glad to hear again from Rabbi Zelig Pliskin in Jerusalem, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I greatly appreciated your interview with Tom Carroll." That was episode number 233. He goes on to say, "I smiled at your mention of your initial feelings about NLP. My experience is that everyone who uses the term NLP will be referring to the people they have in mind when using the term. As you so clearly saw, Tom's character comes through as deeply caring, intelligent, sensible, and practical, with a blend of modesty. I loved his description of the male nurse who was an expert at inserting needles. he describes a fantastic state. The essence of NLP is really modeling excellence. As children, we are all modelers. That is how we learn to speak, with the accent of the people around us, and we learn many skills. His description of David Gordon's state when modeling was fantastic. Modeling happy and joyful people is the way to master happiness and joy. In a different interview, you mentioned Tal Ben-Shahar. I had a number of conversations with him here in Israel. His class at Harvard has had a major impact. Let me insert here, you may recall that he's taught a very successful and popular class at Harvard on positive psychology. Back to Zelig's letter, he says, as he said, it's not his personality, it's the power of his ideas. He is a reserved introvert with an Israeli-accented English. He promotes gratitude, kindness, and similar positive qualities. I also liked Karen Sherman's interview very much. I liked her metaphor of the chairs of young children, which are the right size for them, but we grow up. I loved her intervention with you when you mentioned your concern about possibly not remembering it. I share with you your drive for constantly gaining more knowledge. I appreciated Tom's appreciation of Shrink Wrap Radio. I wish you tremendous success. And that's signed Zelig. Zelig, thanks so much for your appreciations. I appreciate all your appreciations. And the fact that you're going through and listening to some of the older shows, I think working your way through, maybe, I don't know if you're working your way through all of them or not, but certainly working your way toward the present. So I guess I don't know how soon you'll hear this reply, maybe way down the road, or maybe you're simultaneously listening to the most recent ones and then also going back to listen to some of the older ones. Now, something that I mentioned to Zelig that others of you might consider is that when you're responding about specific shows, specific episodes, you might want to leave a comment in the comments area. Now, the comments area is always in the longer portion. If you go to the website, you'll see that often there, under the bio paragraph or two, it may say more, meaning that there's more on that page. So you have to click on the more, and then you'll see, you know, the remaining part of the bio, but you'll also see the area where you can make your comments. So please make use of that so that we get lots of good comments, and it's a good place to put them because then it's very relevant to whoever is reading that or listening to that episode and goes to the website. They'll see the relevant comments. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows, as I just pointed out, in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. You can also leave voicemails on our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Ian McGilchrist, MD, for his mind-bending observations about the impact of brain lateralization on the evolution of Western culture. My next guest will be Australian psychologist Dr. James Alexander, and we'll be discussing his new book on the hidden psychology of pain. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.